It may not be the most pleasant of subjects, but given its place in history and quite likely in our future, war is well worth studying. At least Bevan Alexander thinks so. Alexander has studied the history of war and draws from that study some rules on how wars are won, which he discusses with Drew Burgesson, professor of history at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
Since Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War in the 5th century BC, military analysts have mined the history of past campaigns to divine the rules that promised victory in future wars. Yet the technologies of war have changed radically in recent decades, raising the question of whether these old rules still hold true. My guest today, Bevan Alexander, is a combat historian who has taken on this challenging question in his most recent work, How Wars Are Won, The 13 Rules of War, which appeared in 2002 from Crown Publishers. Bevan, welcome to Talking History.
Delighted to be with you.
Let's begin with the present. How has warfare changed in recent decades?
Well, the form of warfare we even associate with 25 years ago has radically changed. And we see it actually a dramatic change since the Gulf War of 1991. And what has actually taken place is an overwhelming transfer of power from what we traditionally think of as a military structure, that is infantry, artillery, and stuff of that nature, into an air power that now can deliver missiles and bombs to any place on Earth within inches almost of whatever our target is. This has changed the entire nature of warfare.
But nonetheless, you believe that it is still worthwhile to study the history of past wars.
Well, because the rules of war don't change. They've been the same since prehistoric times. So we simply just apply the technology of today to the old rules of war. So what Alexander the Great used for his rules apply just as well to us today.
So, for instance, you praised the campaign waged by the Vietnamese communists. Why is that?
Because they did not strike at our strength. We were overwhelmingly powerful in the air and on the ground. Our weapons were, of course, tremendously strong, and we had the kind of firepower that they could not possibly anywhere come close to equalizing. And so they simply avoided it. And that's how they fought us. They fought us at our weakness, which was the ability of themselves to appear anywhere they wanted to in Vietnam and to strike at our outpost and to strike at our small detachments, to isolate groups that were somehow or another had been put in a position where they were vulnerable, and that's where they struck us. And this was the way that they ultimately won the war.
You suggest also in your book that Robert E. Lee made several mistakes during the U.S. Civil War. Could you describe them?
Well, Robert E. Lee represented a very strong vein in American history, and that is the direct assault on whatever the target that he saw ahead of him. Now, this has been characteristic of military leaders from the earliest days, so it's not just a Southern or it's not just an American characteristic, but it was extreme in the case of Robert E. Lee because we faced at that particular time a new kind of weapon, which was the so-called mini-ball rifle, and we also faced very strong artillery for in warfare. So any direct attack into an in-place position was almost bound to fail. In fact, 5 out of 6 of all the attacks in the Civil War on either side failed. So by the time anybody realized this, they should have stopped making direct frontal attacks, but he did not. And he continued this all the way to the end of the war. Of course, the worst one, as we all know, is the Pickett's charge at Gettysburg in July of 1863, when he sent 13,000 Confederates against a heavily defended cemetery ridge with rifles and artillery banked against him. And this half of the Confederate force was either killed, wounded, or captured in the space of a half an hour.
You often criticize in your book the notion of the frontal attack as simplistic. You also recommend various forms of deception as an alternative. For instance, I remember reading about the Mongol general Subadai, who used the technique of a feigned retreat to defeat the Hungarians in 1241, and as a result, he almost succeeds in conquering all of Europe.
Well, that's quite true. The feigned retreat is one of the rules of warfare, as a matter of fact. In my book, I list 13. The feigned retreat is a method that can be done either psychologically or actually. In the case of Subodai, he simply acted as if he was retreating before the Hungarian army after he had moved into Hungary in the attempt to conquer Europe. And the Hungarian army is much larger than the Mongol army, and he simply backed up, retreated as if he was heading back eastward. The Hungarians, of course, thought this was all true, and they pushed themselves beyond their supports into a deep area where they could not get any help. And Subodai then attacked them frontally with part of his force and then encircled it with the other part of his force and destroyed it.
Right. Other techniques of deception that you describe in your book include holding the enemy in one position while you attack from the side or the rear. Mm-hmm. Another version of that is enveloping your enemy entirely in an all-around attack. These kinds of attacks seem particularly useful for a stronger enemy.
Well, you're talking about a cauldron attacks, is what we what's generally called cauldron attacks. This is the idea where instead of trying to simply flank an enemy or get him to retreat, you surround him. And if you surround him and he has no way of retreating in theory, then he has to surrender. This was, oddly enough, that was the way the Germans attacked the Russians in World War II. Most people think it was a blitzkrieg and a great assault across the plains of Russia. That's not at all true. The Germans used the cauldron or the enveloping system to attack the Russians. And the reason that worked is because Stalin, the Soviet dictator, had lined up the entire Soviet army along the frontier, and it was not, it had no depth. It was simply all lined north to south. And once the Germans punctured this line, they could then pull behind the any particular place and circle a particular element and destroy it. And this was a very successful method, and it's been used for a very, very long time in world history.
It was also our policy during World War II in the Pacific, right? The island hopping.
Well, that was a sort of that was a form of it. You're quite right. It's an adaptation. The remarkable thing about the island hopping is that we faced at every particular island in the Pacific that was occupied by the Japanese the possibility of terrible losses if we assaulted that island. The case of Tororo, which is quite famous in American history by the Marines in 1943, where they lost about 1,100 men in the space of just a little while in this attack on this coral island. This became quite dangerous, and we realized that very quickly that if we did this all the way across the Pacific, we would never get to Japan. And so with the process that was developed was Nimitz, I believe, was the major engineer of this, Chester Nimitz, who was the Pacific commander. He developed the idea that we would capture one island and then move beyond that island to another island farther deeper into the into Japanese waters. And once they captured that island, then we would isolate all the other islands that were Japanese held to the east of this. And this succeeded remarkably well. By the end of the war, we had isolated 2 million Japanese soldiers on islands in the Pacific. And these soldiers never played any role whatsoever in the war. And they were just as effective as if they'd been prisoners of war. They were prisoners of war, as a matter of fact. They just had to support themselves.
Hmm. You also suggest in your book that the best generals don't merely discover weaknesses in their enemy, but actually create them. Some examples that you give in your book are Alexander from Macedonia. Another was Napoleon Bonaparte. What are their tactics? How do they do this?
Well, the idea of creating a weakness in a particular line is, I must say, tends to be limited to extremely capable generals. And why that's true is that the average commander, when he sees a line of force opposed to him, does not see a way to weaken a particular part of that force. He tends to want to try to go around it or in some way to encircle it, like we've talked about earlier. Alexander the Great was the greatest exponent of the attacking, of creating a weakness that we know of in history. But Napoleon, I think Napoleon's case is probably the easiest to explain. In the Battle of Austerlitz in December of 1805, he found that the Russians and the Austrians, this was in Moravia in present-day Czech Republic, he found that that they were getting ready to attack his army, and he purposely weakened his southern front flank of his army, the southern portion of his army, to make the Russians and the Austrians attack that southern portion. He realized in their doing so, they had to cross over an elevation called the Pratzen Heights. And as they crossed over these Pratzen Heights, they would then go and attack the weakened southern part of the Napoleon's army. Napoleon could watch this take place, and he realized that as soon as they crossed and over and went into the southern part, they would vacate the very center of the Russian and Austrian line. And he had already set up a force to attack right into the center of this once it had been vacated. So this is what happened at Austerlitz. So he actually attacked with virtually, he attacked into a void. And this void then cracked the Austrian army, Austrian and Russian army in half, and it was destroyed in the space of minutes.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. For me, the most fascinating principle that you outline in your book is called the central position. Mm-hmm. Can you describe it and tell us a little bit about the story, for instance, how it worked during the Shenandoah Valley Campaign in 1862?
Well, the Shenandoah Valley Campaign is one of the most remarkable in all history. Those American Civil War buffs, of course, know it very well. It had to do with Stonewall Jackson, who commanded a tiny army and that basically stopped the advance of the Union Army into Virginia in 1862, in the spring of 1862. What he basically did was realize that if the Northern Army, which was under a general named Banks, Nathaniel Banks, attacked him, he could withdraw, and he would continue south up the Shenandoah Valley. And as this happened, then there was another Union Army under Fremont that was coming from what present-day West Virginia to a town called Stanton, Virginia, which is in the Shenandoah Valley. And if they got together, then his army would be between these two much larger Union armies and would be destroyed. Jackson did something absolutely astonishing. Instead of retreating so he would then be caught between these two armies, he moved entirely out of the Shenandoah Valley into the eastern part of Virginia to a little place just west of Charlottesville, Virginia, on the railroad. And when he did this, he gave the impression to the Union commanders and to Abraham Lincoln, the president, that he was moving all the way to Richmond or maybe to Fredericksburg, Virginia, to attack other Union forces. And therefore, they said, well, that being the case, there was no need to have any army in the Shenandoah Valley. Everything was lost. He had abandoned the Shenandoah Valley, and therefore they had won. But what he actually did was once he got to this railroad station, he had cars, railroad cars waiting for him, and he put the army on these cars, and instead of going to Richmond, that is to the east, he sent this army west, right straight back to Stanton, Virginia, which is only about an hour and a half away. And he arrived between the two armies, Fremont's army in West Virginia and Banks' army, which is in the Valley of Virginia. Neither one could help the other. So he then was stronger than either army. He attacked Fremont's army, drove it back into West Virginia, then turned and attacked Banks' army and drove it into the Potomac River. It was amazing. He did it twice, but that's the easiest way to explain what he did. One of the most remarkable operations in world history.
So let me read from the conclusion of your chapter on technological superiority. This is what you write. Surprise blows from unexpected places have the potential for neutralizing even the most powerful weapon. The vast technological superiority of the West can lead to the easy assumption that our weapons will always be better and that our enemies will always be easy to beat. Our weapons probably will be better, but their very superiority will lead our opponents to devise new methods to overcome us. Bevin, your book is entitled How Wars Are Won, and you make numerous references to the war on terrorism in particular. What would be your strategy for victory against Al-Qaeda?
I think we are following a very good system now, and that is we are attacking the centers of their power. There's no way we are ever going to attack and win every single cell that exists around the world. We're not going to be able to do that. But we are able to isolate them and make it very difficult for them to attack us and actually achieve anything. One of the things that's astonishing about the terrorists that perhaps not everybody realizes is that they seem to have only the idea that they're going to attack us and at particular places, and of course the 9/11 is quite well known, but they have done this throughout the entire campaigns that they have waged against us since 9/11. That is, they attack little particular places. And these little particular places hurt us very badly in that particular place. But there is no strategic goal, no strategic aim that they have demonstrated for any end plan. In other words, they are attacking places, but they have no way that they can ever achieve any end product. Now, that is a victory.
Right.
We see this, for example, right now in Iraq, where these snipers are killing American soldiers on the streets. I'm sure you've heard about them. Those are painful, and they kill human beings, but they have no effect upon our strategic position at all.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. My guest today has been Bevan Alexander, combat historian, consultant, and author of 7 books on military history, including How Hitler Could Have Won World War II and Lost Victories. His most recent book, How Wars Are Won, is both a consolation and a warning.